Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the report just released by Reporters Without Borders, ranking the freedom of press worldwide in 2014. Josh Stearns, the Press Freedom Director at Free Press, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, U.S. Plummets in Global Press Freedom Rankings, and why the U.S. has plunged 13 points on the Reporters Without Borders Global Press Freedom Rankings to number 46. Then we'll look into how the clock is ticking on the Obama administration's rulemaking process, where critical regulations on food safety, the environment, worker safety, and consumer protection have been stalled for months and even years. Ronald White, the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, joins us to discuss why an array of important rules to be implemented by key government agencies have been stalled and who benefits from this bottleneck, with many of the pending rules having been stalled beyond deadlines set by Congress. Then finally, we will speak with Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist and wrote about her experience in Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. She joins us to discuss her latest book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War, which tells the story of her romance with a fellow soldier in Iraq who was later severely wounded, and their subsequent love and marriage that endured the harrowingly painful challenges of PTSD without sufficient support from the VA and any understanding of the challenges women veterans face. And joining us now is Josh Stearns, who is the Press Freedom Director at Free Press, and he blogs at stearns@wordpress.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, U.S. Plummets in Global Press Freedom Rankings. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Stearns.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this report about U.S. press freedom plummeting comes from a report published by Reporters Without Borders, does it not?
Yeah, it's their annual World Press Freedom Index.
And in terms of that headline, is the U.S. plummeting?
Well, we fell 13 places this year, down to number 46 in the world. So we didn't fall as far as some people, but I think a lot of people are surprised to find the U.S., who holds the First Amendment so dear, so far down the list.
And what can you attribute this to? Is it all to do with Rupert Murdoch?
No, not much at all. While media plurality and media consolidation are part of what Reporters Without Borders looks at, there was a range of other things, including the sort of war on whistleblowers we've seen, the forcing of journalists like New York Times' James Rosen to reveal their sources or to go face jail time, as well as the revelations brought forth by Edward Snowden and the impact of mass surveillance on journalists, not just in the U.S., but around the world. All of those elements kind of contributed to a real drop in our press freedom ranking.
And does that mean, conversely, that other places are improving by comparison? How does it work?
Yeah. So every year when they do these rankings, some of the countries improve and some fall farther down. And the U.S. itself has actually gone back and forth over the years. We were dropped down to 46 about 2 years ago, and then last year we bumped back up to about 33, and now we're back down 46 again. So that sort of yo-yo effect, I think, really illustrates that there's a lot of debate and a lot of issues that we need to address when it comes to press freedom, both in America but around the U.S. I mean, we saw tremendous threats against journalists in Syria and Egypt and Turkey in the past year.
And by the way, Honduras as well is apparently a hideous place for reporters in our own hemisphere. So there's this map that Reporters Without Borders have put out, a color map of the world that's ranked in colors in terms of white is a good situation, yellow is satisfactory situation, orange is noticeable problems, red is difficult situation, and black is very serious situation. And just looking at this map, the good guys seem to be Canada, Iceland, Scandinavia, Ireland, but not England, Poland, and Germany, and New Zealand, and Botswana. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. When you look at the map, it's pretty staggering to see how few places really are marked as white or as sort of free of problems. There really is a global epidemic of threats against journalists and press freedom struggles around the globe.
So let's go to the black, which is the very serious situation, the worst. China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and also the Stans, and Sri Lanka, Cuba. So that's what...
Well, yeah, and it's notable right now as we turn our attention to what's happening in Russia with the Olympics, that a flood of journalists have entered into Russia, but there's a lot of threats facing people in Russia and Mexico. There's actually a great film called Killing the Messenger that just came out this year that tells the personal stories of journalists who've been attacked and suffered really abuses in Mexico, Russia, Syria, and other places. And so there's, I think, a sense right now that these new digital tools have really empowered more and more people to take up the tools of journalism and given reporters and journalists more tools for freedom of expression and freedom of information. But they've also empowered dictatorships and administrations that are willing to clamp down on freedom of expression and interested in using new tools to surveil and silence the press as well.
Well, it does seem that the category above the worst, the black, is the red, which is a difficult situation. And that includes Russia, India, most of Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and most of Africa, and Mexico, and Venezuela, and Colombia.
Yeah, it's really a stunning sort of collection when you look at it all together. And I think one of the things that's useful about an index like this is to track both the changes, but to also understand the connections across these different countries, because really these issues are global. And, while my blog post today and reporting on this issue has really focused on the U.S., because it's where we're based and freepress.net is a domestic organization working on press freedom here, it's important to note that journalists here do enjoy an incredible amount of freedom compared to some of the other nations profiled in this report. And we should be actually working to improve that so that we can really be beacons. Paul Steger of ProPublica said at an award ceremony for the Committee to Protect Journalists last December that we cannot be advocates for press freedom around the globe if we continue to let the Obama administration prosecute whistleblowers and force journalists to reveal their sources and clamp down on freedom of information. We need to keep our house here at home strong if we're going to try to inspire others and work towards media freedom around the globe.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Josh Stearns, who's the Press Freedom Director at Free Press, and he blogs at stearns.wordpress.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, U.S. Plummets in Global Press Freedom Rankings. And we're talking about these Global Press Freedom Rankings that's just been issued by Reporters Without Borders. And I'm looking at this color map now of the world, where we've talked about the worst countries and the best and the difficult situations, the second worst. And let's talk about the second best, if you will, which includes the United States and Australia. Interesting enough, there, Australia is right next door. New Zealand has a good situation right next door to the United States. Canada has a better situation. And right next door to England, Ireland has a better situation. So what's going on in the United States, England, Australia to rank them below these other countries? I made the joke about Rupert Murdoch, who obviously his newspapers dominate Australia. What's your understanding of why these countries aren't ranked up with the top?
Sure. Well, Rupert Murdoch is ironically, has a pretty large footprint in all the countries that you mentioned. And media consolidation is one of the issues that Reporters Without Borders looks at. But the countries that you mentioned, the U.S., Great Britain, Australia, are also all part of the sort of Five Eyes Alliance, which has been part of a sort of global network around mass surveillance. And so they've been very much under scrutiny since the revelations of Edward Snowden. And in the UK, for example, who only dropped three places, which I might quibble with given the fact that they've forced the Guardian newspaper to destroy hard drives related to Edward Snowden, that they've hauled the editor for The Guardian up to Parliament to testify on his loyalty to country, and they've detained Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, for 9 hours under terrorism charges so they could seize his electronics equipment. So, there's been some pretty staggering abuses in the UK over the last year that have really illustrated how this issue of mass surveillance intersects with press freedom in really fundamental ways.
So in terms of the U.S. then, what's been the pushback from the main newspapers, etc. Is this troubling journalists? It should be.
It should be, and it is. And over the last year, we've seen a series of really important actions. And I think, you know, one press freedom index by itself, you know, could be an outlier. So you could look at this data and say, well, you know, I don't know that I trust one statistic. But this comes on the heels of a series of reports. The Committee to Protect Journalists, which is largely a global press freedom organization, released for the first time ever a U.S. press freedom report because things have gotten so bad for journalists in Washington, D.C. and their access to the Obama administration and the steps that have been taken there to clamp down on leaks. So you've got the CPJ report. You've got the Columbia Tao Center for Digital Journalism released a really important piece on mass surveillance in journalism. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press has been incredibly active over the past year fighting these subpoenas for journalists' records and other issues. And so we've seen newsrooms, press freedom organizations, open government groups, and civil liberties groups really coming together over the past year to try to redefine and reclaim press freedom in America, to make sure that we really put that at the center. If we believe that journalism is really fundamentally connected to democracy, then there's a fight to be had there to really try to repair sort of some of the damage that's been done.
And I take it that things like the secret seizure of the Associated Press phone records, that I would think had a lot to do with the decline, right? Plunging 13 spots, though, that's a bit of a fairly precipitous plunge, is it not?
Well, that was a key thing that they mentioned in their report. The Reporters Without Borders cited that Department of Justice secret seizure of 20 AP phone records. But you know, they also noted that the DOJ took steps to actually change their protocols after that. They were sort of taken to task by President Obama, and they've updated their guidelines around that. However, they're still pursuing James Rosen risen from the New York Times, to forcing him to testify against his source. And so you see kind of the Department of Justice speaking out of both sides of their mouth, trying to have a mea culpa for secretly seizing these journalists' phone records, but then continuing to push bad policies that put people like, you know, longtime reporters from the New York Times, but also digital freelance journalists like Barrett Brown, who all he did was post a link to stolen documents. He had no sort of involvement in the stealing of these documents that were secret files about, you know, government contractors and the intelligence agencies. And he posted a link in a chat room to these documents as he was doing his research, and he is now facing 105 years in prison. And this is another case that the Reporters Without Borders report cites.
Well, but just in the last couple of minutes, how do you make the distinction between the governments and the press? Because it's a separate issue. I mean, the press is not the same as the government. The AP did not allow itself to be hacked by the government. It happened to them. They're victims. So how do you distinguish, I mean, and of course, in a lot of the third world, the press are basically, you know, literally the government pays people to write stories about them. So there's a whole different standard in a lot of the world. But how do you distinguish between the government and the press in terms of these rankings? I mean, it sounds like the governments are the problems, not necessarily the newspapers, although we do have, as I've mentioned before, we have Rupert Murdoch, who voluntarily has become the Pravda of the Republican Party. That, of course, flies in the face of tradition of press freedom. So it's possible that a media company can turn itself over to be the propaganda arm of a government.
Well, you know, I think that that's one of the things that Reporters Without Borders is careful to distinguish, is that, you know, where they are concerned about, like, media consolidation, they're concerned about it from a very practical policy level, because the media we have didn't just happen because of the free market. It happened because of policy decisions that allowed Rupert Murdoch to own what he owns, or allowed, you know, other consolidation to happen. So I think they're pretty clear, and that's where Free Press and our work that we work on media consolidation really looks at not going after the media companies, but really trying to make sure that the structural policy issues that shape our media are informed by real voices from real people around the country. So that's the work that we do, is trying to engage people all around the country to stand up for journalism, really, and to protect journalism, and to make sure that our media policies reflect the demands and the will of the people.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Josh Stearns.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Stearns, who's the Press Freedom Director at Free Press, and he blogs at stearns.wordpress.com and has an article at the Huffington Post, U.S. Plummets in Global Press Freedom Rankings. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into why important rules for government agencies have been stalled at the White House. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ronald White, who is the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Centre for Effective Government, where he focuses on the application of scientific information in the development and implementation of public health policy, with specific interests including air pollution policy, chemical and nanotechnology risks, and environmental justice. Ron also serves on the Department of Environmental Health Sciences, Epidemiology, and Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and is a member of the State of Maryland Air Quality Control Advisory Council. Previously served in the Department of Environmental Health Services and Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins, where he also served as Deputy Director for the Johns Hopkins Risk Sciences and Public Policy Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald White.
Thank you very much.
And is it true that regulations go to die at the White House?
Well, that certainly seems to have been the case. Certainly in the last several years, we haven't seen the kind of movement for regulations. In fact, we've seen the blockage of regulation through this centralized review office that exists in the White House called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is part of the Office of Management and Budget, which, of course, controls all of the not only financial information for the executive branch of the government, but also reviews all of the regulations that government agencies, executive agencies produce. So they have a lot of control over whether regulations go forward or not, and certainly, in the last 3 years or so, we've seen a real lack of movement in some areas for really important regulations that are necessary to protect public health, welfare, and safety.
And is Cass Sunstein still in charge of that office?
No. He left last year, and he's been replaced by Howard Schlansky, is the name of the administrator of that office, of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. And he did, as part of his confirmation, commit to moving regulations forward, and he came on board last summer of 2013 and has made some progress for some regulations that were stuck in some cases for a year or more in this review black hole. But frankly, not nearly as much progress as we continue to hope will take place, and certainly, there's a lot more regulations now that are still waiting to be important regulations that are waiting to be issued and finalized.
Well, it seems, though, that going back, for example, to the experience of Van Jones, who was hired as the White House green guy, and he's now on CNN's Crossfire. But he told me a long time ago when he got to the White House, he couldn't believe how the playing field was not level in terms of environmental lobbying, that essentially the room was full of executives and lobbyists from ExxonMobil, but there was barely an environmentalist to be seen. Is that the nature of Washington, that it's just so overwhelmed by money that you already, if you're working in the public interest, you're already at an incredible disadvantage?
Well, I think that certainly in terms of resources and in some cases access to the most senior level decision makers in the executive branch, that is the case. I think you are at a disadvantage, and I don't think that's a big secret. Clearly, money talks, and that's certainly the case with Congress and access and influence to a lot of congressional members. But even in the White House, I think there's certainly, in terms of the amount of information that they can receive, the amount of lobbying that they get from industry and their allies far outweighs and overwhelms what can be done by the public interest groups. That said, I think the public interest groups, are as effective as they can potentially be, given the limited resources that we have. And I think we try to make the most from what we have, and frankly, what we have available to us is the support of the American people on all of these issues that we're weighing in on. Because whether it comes to environmental protections or protection of the quality of the food and the safety of the food that people are eating, or whether it relates to abuses of financial practices across the board, the American people strongly support those kinds of protections. And so we're able to weigh in with real people at the grassroots levels, who then really, can explain why these things are so important. But it is an uphill fight. There's no question about it, that industry certainly has massive amounts of resources, and they deploy those resources to try and delay regulations or to change regulations so that it works to their advantage.
Again, I'm speaking with Ronald White, who's the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, where he focuses on the application of scientific information in the development and implementation of public health policy with specific interests, including air pollution policy, chemical and nanotechnology risks, and environmental justice. And the White House is well beyond these deadlines, haven't they? Aren't they set by Congress in terms of implementing these rules? And we're talking about food safety rules, environmental rules, worker safety rules, and also Wall Street reform. So what's the sense of what these roadblocks are about? Are they about what we're talking about? The lobbyists just are able to gum up the works?
Well, I think in the last couple of years, leading up to the last election in 2012, I think there were certainly a major political calculus to the delays that were going on in some of these major rules that had consequences for big industry. And there was a report done by a independent governmental body called the Administrative Conference of the United States, and they actually issued a report late last year that looked into this issue of what was involved, what was behind the delays that occurred, let's say, from 2011 through the election period of 2012 and even into 2013. And what they found was that there were a series of factors that were involved with this office that I was mentioning before, this Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, part of the Office of Management and Budget, that really did all sorts of shenanigans in terms of forcing agencies not to submit rules unless they had accepted all of the comments from this particular review organization in the White House, or saying you can't submit a rule unless you withdraw a rule, or saying we don't want you to submit this rule, or being told by the White House, likely, we believe that, no, we don't want this rule to move forward because it has potential political implications for us. So we believe that there was a significant political component to delaying rules in that period in the run-up to the 2012 election, which unfortunately carried over into 2013 as well, because there was this huge backlog of rules that had just been backed up for more than a year and a half and close to 2 years. So that was certainly a key factor. The politics was certainly a key factor. But there's no doubt that industry is very, very adept at raising issues, raising concerns, raising uncertainty about the scientific basis of rules, raising concerns about how rules are going to be implemented and the potential impacts that those might have on their, on the economy and on their particular industries. And they are very adept, and they've been in this game for a long time. They know how to create uncertainty, how to create delay, and how to influence the regulatory process in a very, very direct way.
Well, I specifically have investigated over the years, the for-profit college industry, which is truly egregious. You know, student debt now is equal to household debt, and the taxpayer subsidizes these for-profit colleges to the tune of about $33 billion a year. And they get aspiring vets and people from minority communities into these indentured deals, which is all taxpayers' money. They spend an enormous amount of money, of taxpayer money, again, promoting themselves on television. You see every other day there's a new school popped out of nowhere. And their practices are so egregious that the White House did try to reform that through Cass Sunstein. And apparently at the last moment, the head of the Washington Post, Graham, who owns Kaplan, which is a big part of the for-profit college industry, sort of went to the White House and basically killed him because, you know, he had some clout. This is before he sold out to Amazon. So that's an example of the way the game is played. And I'm just curious to know, I mean, in terms of moral outrage, I don't think there's anything worse than ripping off kids who are trying to make it in the American dream and indenturing them for life with worthless diplomas.
Well, that, you know, I certainly understand, you know, your outrage about it. I think there are a lot of other outrages. There's outrages about the fact that some very, very important protections for our environment need to move forward and hopefully will move forward in the next couple of years as this administration has a rapidly closing window to really get things done, which they in some cases have committed to, for example, in terms of fighting this problem, this huge problem that we have in terms of climate change and the greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change and global warming. And the administration laid out a climate action plan last year, indicating they were going to develop regulations on the emissions of these greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change for power plants, first for new power plants, which they have proposed. And now they're on schedule to do so for, which is much more important, for current existing power plants. Nobody's really talking about building new coal-fired power plants in the United States. But the rules that will be developed, hopefully, by this June, we'll see. That's the presidential order as part of the deadline in the president's climate action plan called for developing regulations for existing power plants by this June. And we hope the president holds EPA to that deadline as well. But certainly in terms of things like food safety, it's certainly a big issue. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of people who get sick every single year from contaminated food and that we know of, and probably thousands more that go unreported, thousands more cases of sickness from contaminated food. Now, Congress responded to the outbreaks that occurred over the last several years by passing new legislation that required the Food and Drug Administration to adopt new food safety rules. Those rules were supposed to be in place by July of 2012. Well, FDA is still in the process of issuing those regulations, still hasn't done it for all of the regulations that were supposed to be in place more than a year and a half ago. So clearly, there is still much to do, and this administration really has its work cut out for them. Another area is protecting workers. One of the rules that has been in limbo for more than two decades is protecting construction workers and other workers who work and are exposed to silica. Which is a substance. It's the stuff that is like quartz that's in materials and causes lung cancer, and it causes disease silicosis, which robs people of their ability to breathe, and it causes renal disease and kidney disease. This is very, very serious stuff, and the Department of Labor, in terms of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is part of the Department of Labor, had been working on regulations to lower the exposure limit for worker exposure to silica for years and years and years. In fact, going back more than 20 years, still hadn't been done. Finally, in the last 9 months, things have moved forward after these rules were sitting in review, limbo, for more than a year. But we're only now getting to the point where just finalizing the opportunity for the public and industry and others to submit comments to OSHA. There'll be hearings next month, but it'll probably be another year to 2 years before this very important regulation that's been in the work for decades actually becomes reality. So these are just some of the examples of some of the delays that have occurred and some of the opportunities that still lie ahead in the next 2 to 3 years for the Obama administration.
But in terms of what the president pledged in his recent State of the Union to move forward with executive actions, specifically to raise the minimum wage for people working on government contracts, does that pledge extend to what we're talking about?
He mentioned the climate change problem, greenhouse gas, in passing. But he really didn't highlight that, unfortunately. And none of these other areas that we've just been talking about really were included in the State of the Union. We had hoped they would be. And they weren't. So we're part of a coalition called the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. It's made up of many groups who are environmental groups and public interest groups protecting consumers and folks concerned about, organizations concerned about food safety and financial products and how banks and others operate in a way that protects the public interest. So it's a large, broad coalition of groups concerned about the safeguards that we have in our society. And this coalition sent a letter to the president, in fact, in January, asking him to really follow through on some of these commitments that are out there and to really take advantage of the remaining period of his administration to move a lot of these initiatives forward. We didn't really hear that in the State of the Union, but we're hoping still that we can weigh in and make some of these and take advantage of some of these opportunities that exist to really move the public interest agenda forward and really ensure that these public safeguards are in place.
Well, just in closing, though, in terms of the Wall Street reforms, the Dodd-Frank Reform Act that Congress passed, half of the rules have not been implemented, and they're being slow-walked, and we know how much pressure was put against trying to kill the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But the SEC, for example, they could move on transparency for corporations who put money into government as a way for citizens who since the Citizens United decision, there's unlimited funds coming from people that don't have to, billionaires and corporations who don't have to reveal who they are. That's a loophole, I think, that could be really useful, particularly in this election year.
There's no doubt that there still are significant delays in implementing the Dodd-Frank Act and that in the area of financial reform, there's still a lot more work that needs to be done, and things have dragged on. There's no doubt about it. There is a real opportunity here for the Securities and Exchange Commission to really make some progress in protecting the public and providing transparency, as you've pointed out, in terms of how funds are being used for influencing how government operates. And that's sorely needed.
Well, Ron White, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ronald White, who's the Director of Regulatory Policy at the Center for Effective Government, where he focuses on the applications of scientific information in the development and implementation of public health policy, with specific interests including air pollution policy, chemical and nanotechnology risks, and environmental justice. Ron also serves in the Departments of Environmental Health Services, Epidemiology, and Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and is a member of the State of Maryland's Air Quality Control Advisory Council. And previously he served in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins, where he also served as Deputy Director for the Johns Hopkins Risk Sciences and Public Policy Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Army veteran Kayla Williams about her new book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War.
Music. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Thank you for having me.
And just to touch on Iraq before we get into your very, very personal story, when you were with the 101st, were you ever in Fallujah?
No, I wasn't. I don't know about while we were there, but historically, over the course of the war, the Marines are more...
Sure, they're in Anbar mostly.
Yeah.
Now, I was just going to ask you, you know, just a general, when we see the black flag flying over government buildings, it does raise questions about what, you know, was it worth it?
Well, I mean, I didn't believe that we should have gone into Iraq to begin with, and seeing things fall apart once again now is, of course, tremendously depressing. The Iraqi people who I personally met while I was there wanted to tell me about the suffering that they had endured under the Ba'ath regime, but I'm not sure if we'll know for a generation or more whether what they've been left with now ended up being better.
So just to stay with Iraq, you met your husband, right, at a mountain outpost in 2003?
That's right. We were on Sinjar Mountain in northern Iraq near the border with Syria. And it was not very romantic. It's not like we could go out on dates. I was on the listening team that made up the LPOP, Listening Post Observation Post, and he was in charge of the observation team. He would bring them resupply and spell some of the guys when they went on mid-tour leave, for example. I thought he was really interesting, smart, funny, charismatic, and very handsome, but I knew we couldn't start a romantic relationship there. One night I did confess to him that I wanted to get to know him better, and he said, there's plenty of time for that when we get home. And a few months later, he was very severely wounded by a roadside bomb, or IED, improvised explosive device, that sent shrapnel through his skull under the Kevlar towards the back of his head, and it traveled forward and exited near his eye. So for several days, it sounded like I would never have that chance to get to know him better, as the prognosis for his survival was very, very low at the beginning. He did survive, emailed me once he had recovered a little bit and started to stabilize and was in a hospital back in America. We stayed in touch that way until I got home. He was released from Walter Reed Army Medical Center and sent back to Fort Campbell, our permanent duty station, just a couple of weeks before the rest of the division got back from the Middle East.
So in the period when he was just after he was hit by the IED, did you visit him in the field hospital?
No, he was evacuated to Baghdad, and then about probably a day later from Baghdad to Germany, and then from Germany back to the United States. And even if I had wanted to, there's no way that the Army would have been interested in sending me, because I mean we weren't married or anything, and
sure.
And of course they were concerned exclusively with keeping him alive and getting him to where he could be safe. So even if I had made such a request, they would not have honored it.
So there's a spark of romance. Then he has this terrible accident. He's sent back to the States. And then when do you see him again?
He was injured October 17th of 2003, and then I got off the plane coming home from the Middle East on February 8th of 2004. As soon as I had my car back and had access to a phone, I called him and went and picked him up, and we started dating that night.
And did you detect a changed person?
At the beginning, it was... I was a changed person too. So it was tough for me in those very early days to untangle what might be cognitive or psychological differences that resulted from the brain injury and the fact that he then developed severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I was so discombobulated by my own reintegration that I perhaps willfully ignored some of the early signs, or blew them off and didn't take them seriously. I really didn't know anything about brain injuries. So when he said, oh, the doctor said I'm going to be okay, I just took that at face value. And it wasn't until about a month later, when I had to go back to work, we got a month of vacation when we first got home. When I had to go back to work and my routine normalized and I stopped staying up all night drinking and partying, which a lot of people did when we first got home, and went back to a more regular regimen, and he didn't because his unit told him to just stay home because he couldn't wear a hat, because his wound was still too fresh. He couldn't carry a weapon because of the PTSD. They told him not to come into work, and he just continued to get worse at that point. He was drinking to manage the depression and anxiety that he was feeling, and I started to see that he was unable to pay his bills, for example. The cognitive deficits made it impossible for him to manage his own finances. And that was when I started to really sense that something was profoundly wrong, which became increasingly apparent over the next few months.
And again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. And of course, the irony of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, from what you've just told us, is the title of your book. So that kind of a brain injury, I mean, wouldn't it be pretty clear that to the medical authorities, to the VA authorities, that this was a very serious wound? I mean, the idea that somebody that would go through that was essentially allowed to sit at home and drink doesn't seem to me like particularly good follow-on.
No, it wasn't. I was astonished at what was happening. When he was released from Walter Reed, they sent him back to Fort Campbell, and he just got lost in the system. I assume that Walter Reed thought when he got back to Fort Campbell that he would be assigned to a medical holding company, but he wasn't. For some reason, he was just put back with his artillery battery, and they didn't know what to do with him, and so they just neglected him, quite frankly. I don't blame his unit leadership necessarily, because they were busy trying to prepare to go back to war, and they had no training in how to take care of somebody with these severe injuries. Brian was told when they released him from Walter Reed, well, you can walk and talk and wipe your own butt, so we really can't keep you here. There's nothing else we can do for you. Remember, this was in the very early days of the war, October 2003, the beginning of what came to be a very long war. And there was a lot still unknown about brain injuries, about post-traumatic stress disorder. If he had been injured a few years later, he would have been sent to a VA, a Department of Veterans Affairs, polytrauma center, where he would have gotten much more intensive treatment, rehabilitation, handled by a team of case managers that would have worked really closely together. And then from there, when he was sent back to Fort Campbell, would have been assigned to a warrior transition unit, a special unit that the Army developed to make sure that wounded warriors were getting adequate case management, treatment, and support navigating the complicated bureaucracy. But in those early days, those resources didn't exist, and he just slipped through the cracks. Once I saw and his mother saw that he was just spiraling downward and getting much worse away from the hospital environment, we worked to get him transferred back to Walter Reed as an outpatient, which happened in December of 2004. And so once he was back at Walter Reed, he at least was under more regular care by medical providers and in a setting where people had a better understanding of the types of injuries he had suffered, both physically and psychological.
So in terms of your relationship, you went back to your unit and he's there alone in the dark, as you described it earlier. When's the next time that you get back together?
Well, we continued to date that whole time. We were living in the same general area, and I was doing my best to help him, but not with any training in how to do so, and without any understanding of brain injuries or psychological injuries. So I was trying to help, but I didn't know how. And at the same time, I was trying to deal with my own reintegration, my own challenges in coming home from war. Then we'd been dating for about 10 months when he was sent back to Walter Reed. We stayed in touch and ended up getting married in February of 2005. And then when I left active duty, I moved to the D.C. area to join him and help him with his recovery more directly once I was both his spouse and living with him and out of the military. It's one of the reasons I chose to get out of the Army, was seeing that he wasn't getting the care that he needed and that somebody needed to kind of take over and be responsible for helping him on his road to recovery.
But in terms of this is a full-time job, I mean, what kind of financial support did you and your husband get, given that?
Well, at that point, he was still on active duty. It took mm-hmm. the military 2 years to medically retire him. And so we were getting his active duty paycheck and the housing allowance that comes along with it. Once they medically retired him, that was actually quite a shock to us, because it happened. There was no progress for so long, 2 years, and then when it happened very swiftly, and we didn't have much notice, and his paycheck was suddenly gone, and we didn't know how long it would be before the Department of Veterans Affairs processed his disability application, and the suddenness with which it happened, we both ended up on unemployment until I started working. I had a job offer, but it was taking some time for the paperwork to all go through. And that was really humiliating for both of us as combat veterans to end up on unemployment, because we didn't know how to take care of ourselves in this transition period that was not a smooth one at all. Luckily, within a couple of months, his disability paperwork had gone through and he started getting disability payments, and then my job started, and once I was working, you know, we did fine. But yeah, that was a scary transition period for both of us.
Well, but somehow you and your husband stay together. I mean, you you have three children. I mean,
he calls me hard-headed.
So, you know, the attraction must have outweighed the pain, as you describe in your new book, Kayla Williams, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War.
The
code black, as you referred to those moments.
Yeah, the worst of his PTSD symptoms were pretty terrible. He would have some what we came to call his code black times, when the PTSD symptoms would really overpower him and he would even become violent. He was starting fights in bars. He was drinking to excess, and occasionally his violence was even directed at me. It was very frightening. Part of it was, perhaps as I mentioned, that I'm just stubborn. Part of it was the love. And also there was just, I went on a completely baseless, I had no reason to have it, but this faith that he would get better, that somehow if I tried hard enough, I could help him recover. And also there was this feeling that I couldn't leave a wounded comrade. It wasn't his fault that he got hurt. It wasn't as if he was just born a jerk. He was injured in a war that I was also in. And the thought of abandoning him to fight his demons alone was something that it's not that I didn't consider it. I did. There were times that it was bad enough that I thought about leaving, because it was very hard. But ultimately, I couldn't go through with it. And I mean, I think you've probably heard of politicians who have divorced their wives while their wives were getting breast cancer treatment, and we all think, like, oh, what an awful human being. Like, who does that, right? And it was like that for me with this as well. He had an injury. He developed psychological problems as a result of his war trauma. It seemed as if it would have been ethically wrong to just walk away when he so desperately needed somebody to help him on that road to healing.
And were you confident that you were on the road to healing, that it would if not go away, at least be contained? Because the injury itself is so terrible. When you talk, if a piece of shrapnel comes from through the back of your head and comes out your eye, my God, it's amazing that he's still alive, you know?
It is, yeah. The neurosurgeon, I tracked down his neurosurgeon to interview him for the book so that I would have a better understanding of what the surgery itself was like. And the neurosurgeon actually had photos, which shocked me that he had them after all those years. And getting to see the images was really, it really was very affecting. I can't quite describe what it's like to see a photograph of my husband's brain with the skull, a piece of the skull removed, so that the doctor could remove pieces of shrapnel from it. And the neurosurgeon said that when he put Brian on the plane back to Germany for further care, he believed Brian would never be functionally independent, would never be able to live on his own, take care of himself, and that he might never walk again. He might be confined to a wheelchair. If he walked, the neurosurgeon believed he would use a walker. So I didn't know that when we were going through all this. I just knew that I knew who he had been, and I had faith that he could get back to being a man that I could love. And I ended up being right. It just took maybe three times as long as I thought it would. It was hard. He didn't, because as I described, there were gaps, huge gaps in the systems of care when he was injured that I think the military and the VA have gone a long way towards fixing. But in those early, he didn't get any cognitive rehabilitation. He wasn't checked into an inpatient rehab center. So he didn't get a lot of assistance in those early days. And it wasn't until he had been medically retired and started working again, he got a job just stocking shelves at a sporting goods store, and it started to help him learn some new skills and rebuild his self-confidence that he could be a contributing member of society, that he could do something useful again. And the routine and the schedule made him stop drinking as much, and not drinking as much meant we got in fewer arguments, and he started sleeping better at night. And so we had gone through this downward spiral, getting worse and worse and worse for a period of a couple years after his injury. And then we were able to turn the corner, and he went on a similar spiral back up the other direction, where every good thing that happened built on another good thing and added to another good thing. And so we moved in the right direction. And it took a long time, though, from the time of his injury until he read a book again, cover to cover, was 6 years. It took 6 years until he had had enough recovery of cognitive function to be able to read a book again.
So in terms of the power of love versus the healing process of the human body, and this is obviously a case of a human being going through extraordinary trauma and somehow surviving, and in the course of this struggle that you had to hold on to a relationship and to build a marriage and to have three children, give me a sense of, I mean, I'm reading between the lines here that your story is really a testament to the power of love.
Thank you for saying so. Yes, I want to communicate to people that this, although, yes, I do describe some of the worst parts, ultimately, this is a story of hope, healing, recovery, and love. And we spend a lot of time talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. And, yes, that is a very real part of the aftermath of trauma, combat or otherwise. But the flip side of that can be post-traumatic growth, that the war trauma that Brian experienced much more severely than I did, but, I experienced my own challenges in combat. And that trauma set the stage for us to also exhibit a lot of growth, to develop a deeper and more profound appreciation for how lucky we are to live with tremendous privilege in modern America, to have a deeper degree of connection to our fellow human beings, and to really appreciate what we owe to society, the society that has invested in us and helped us on our path to recovery, and that we are committed to continuing to contribute to our communities and serve in new ways.
Yeah, but what about what our society owes to you and your husband? I mean, isn't that a that's
Yeah, absolutely. My hope is that civilians can and those who have never served can read this book and understand more fully the types of sacrifices that our troops and military families make, and see and recognize that even though that recovery process can be a challenging and long one, we can still be contributing members of society. We can be great employees, and we're not permanently broken, but that we do, since we as a society sent our troops to war, we as a society now have an obligation to fulfill commitments to them. And the best thing when people say, what can I do to help the troops, or what can I do to help veterans, the answer is simple. You can vote. You can research what your politicians do and how they vote, and you can vote accordingly and let them know how you want them to act on your behalf. We have a commitment to take care of those who have served us, to our troops and veterans. We have a commitment now to ensure that our politicians are adequately funding and overseeing the Department of Veterans Affairs to make sure that those veterans are properly cared for in the years to come.
Well, Kayla Williams, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She is a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women's Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Angel song.